Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butter fat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice of chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label. And for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
Every kid in my generation owned a copy. And when you'd go to a kid's birthday party, they would have had one of these cakes baked for them. Part of the joy of it was like, what are you choosing on the playground? Like, are you getting the pool cake? It was the joy of the joy and the pain of having to just choose one every year and then going and seeing like how that was interpreted by that family.
You're listening to the Taste Podcast. I'm Editor-in-Chief Matt Rodbard, here with Senior Editor Anna Heasel.
On this episode, Matt speaks with Odette Williams, the author of Simple Cake, and to Austin Bush, the author and photographer of The Food of Northern Thailand. Austin's also written and photographed a few stories for Taste over the years. But Matt, let's talk about simple cakes. What makes Odette's cake so simple?
Well, this book is basically making the argument that you only need 10 basic cake recipes. Odette shows you how to mix and match these base recipes with toppings and decorations, whether you're making a decorated birthday cake or just sprinkling some powdered sugar on top and snacking on the cake while it's still warm. We've all done that, Anna.
We have. It's great. You need a good snacking cake every once in a while.
Got to go for the snacking cake, yeah.
And Austin, of course, we love Austin. He's written for Taste. He's the photographer of the Pock Pock Cookbooks by Andy Ricker.
Yeah, stick around for the Austin Bush interview. Austin has lived in Thailand for almost 20 years. He speaks the language. He's traveled extensively through the region. And I think I've gone on the record, and if not, here we are on the record. I'm going to say The Food of Northern Thailand is my favorite cookbook of 2018. It is remarkable. You need to buy it. I love it.
It's a good one. In the meantime, here's Matt with Odette Williams.
Odette Williams, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Aw, thanks for having me.
It's been so great picking through your book, Simple Cake. I want to hear a little bit about just really what got you interested in baking.
Well, I would say what got me baking really was the fact that when I was growing up in my household, there was nothing sweet. So I was like out of desperation. I would come home from school and I didn't want a Vegemite sandwich. So
we have to talk about that. So continue.
Yeah, we have to get back to the Vegemite.
Yeah.
And so I would be like rummaging around for something sweet and there wouldn't be anything. And so I somehow managed to figure out how to make cake batter. And so I would just make the cake batter and I'd just eat it. I wouldn't even bake the cake.
You were like before cake batter was a flavor of ice cream.
Yeah.
And was, that's so cool.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And because in Australia, you didn't have all those crazy ice cream flavors or cake flavors. It was like, and then I got so good at it that I just like managed to even scale a batter. So if I just wanted like, you know, a cup of batter for afternoon tea, I'd just be able to make it, eat it. And so I think that I just had like this, it was the simple ingredients that were on hand at home that I could access that then kind of led me to cake.
And you were crafty too.
Yeah, I must have. Like, yeah, because the only other sweet thing in the house was vitamin C. So, you know, like, it's like, all right.
So tell me, growing up in Sydney or in Australia, you grew up in Sydney?
I kind of grew up all around Australia. I was born in Newcastle, which is like 2 hours north of Sydney. And then we moved to Canberra. And then we went to the West Coast for 4 years. Yeah. And then back to Sydney.
Ended up in Sydney. Okay.
Yeah, the most of my life.
Tell me, what was it like growing up? I want to know what dessert is like in Australia. I find it really fascinating. I've traveled there and I've had great desserts there and pastries, but you've got obviously a very strong British influence.
Yeah.
But you also have proximity to the tropics. So you've got tropical fruit and you've got a lot of, you know, Asian inspiration. So what is it like there in terms of baking?
I mean, I think that, I mean, Australia just has great food. Like mm-hmm. the produce there is so good. I think it's like the equivalent of like your California.
Sure, definitely.
And I think also too, Australians love bread and do bread really well. So there's like a lot of bakeries, like a lot of independent bakeries that say bake their own bread, and then they'll offer like a small selection of sweet, you know, baked yeah. goods and coffee. So, and there's definitely the English influence. Like they're much more, I think, aligned to like what is like the tea cake or okay. A Devonshire tea. And it's like, I think that with Southeast Asia, I mean, you get like all that yummy stuff that isn't so much baking, but you get all the sweet rice puddings mm-hmm. and the coconut milk. And I think also with fruit, you kind of get the pavlova and you get all those like amazing fruits like passion fruit, which is like it costs a fortune to get here.
I mean, and that's something that we've only been doing in the States for like a decade or a decade and a half, but it's been in Australia for much longer, yeah. it seems.
Yeah. I mean, that was the dessert of everyone's childhood, really. At Christmas time,
yeah.
you know, you would make the pavlova, you'd have the whipped cream, you'd have all the, you know, the fruits on top.
God, pavlova is such an underrated cake.
It really is. And actually, Kelly, my editor, and I, when we were like
yeah.
really narrowing down the 10 cakes, I really advocated, I think we've got to have a meringue in there because mm-hmm. it's a true celebration cake, you know?
So I want to get into the format of Simple Cake because it's really smart and I've not seen it before. So you've got 10 bases, base cakes, and you've got 15 toppings and you can interchange everything. Explain how this works.
Yeah. Well, I guess the concept really is if you know these few things, you know a lot. You have like a great arsenal and none of them are particularly complicated. And I think that once you get familiar with that recipe, it becomes like a lifetime friend. So you can turn to it and know what it's going to be and know you can do it. And I think by bringing in the options and like containing them, it gives you confidence, mm-hmm. I think, in an area where some people get a bit unraveled.
So what are some of the bases? Take us through a few of your favorites.
Well, I mean, there's all the usual suspects,
yeah.
you know, like it's like chocolate, you know, yeah. and it's a chocolate cake that doesn't require any fancy equipment. It doesn't require beaters. If you've got two bowls and a whisk, you can pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got like some serious shelf life. And it's also, I think, like a lot of the recipes in the book, it's got wiggle room for people to, you know, maybe not get things so precise. Yeah. Like, for instance, if you're using the flour, you could interchange it. You know, if you wanted to, if you looked in the pantry and you only had all-purpose or you had cake flour, mm-hmm. it's still going to work.
Oh, that's good to know. And tell me, with chocolate cake, what are some of the toppings that we can put on there?
Oh, my God. Where do I begin?
I know. I'm asking you to pick your favorites.
Well,
it's hard.
I think that actually what I really advocate for in the book is that my favorite topping on a cake is actually dusted confectioner's sugar mm-hmm. because I think it's the simplest. It's not too sweet. You know, like it's the cake base is good enough on its own that if you just cut that cake just even slightly warm and it's dusted with confectioner's sugar, like that is my happy
Let's
place.
Let the cake speak.
Let it speak.
Because a lot of times we spend all this time making this great cake.
It's true. And then you like
slather it on.
You destroy it with like 50% buttercream.
Yeah.
And I really actually, and that's something that I really, you know, out of all that cupcake era that I was really turned off in the end, the cake to buttercream ratio.
Completely.
I thought this is kind of getting a bit obnoxious.
Yeah, like, you'd have like an inch of cake and
yeah.
then it'd be the topping.
Yeah, and the cake would be stale underneath, you know. And so that whole balance is like, I find that kind of cake, it's not my kind of cake.
No, definitely.
I really just want simple, delicious homemade cake. And I think that like, that's why confectioner's sugar or like some whipped cream on the side. And I'm 100% behind like cutting it warm, like uh-huh. not even waiting for it to cool. Because that's the thing, when you put on buttercream and other things, you got to wait for it to cool. And And look, I know I'm boo-hooing the buttercream, but I do actually have a really good
buttercream. I'm sure you do.
I have a good buttercream recipe in there that's got some mascarpone in there to, like, cut through the sweetness.
I like your style. Give us a few more of these fundamental cake bases that we're going to cook through in Simple Cake.
All right. Well, there's a vanilla, of course, because vanilla is like the queen of, like, flavors in baking. And then there is a really lovely milk and honey cake, which is kind of not your typical honey cake. Honey cake is usually, like, super sweet, pretty rich. And so I've kind of, like, thrown in some buttermilk to kind of cut through it.
Yeah, sure.
So it's just light and lovely and fluffy. And then you've got, like, your classic olive oil, an apple cider cake.
Oh, good.
Or, like, fall. I mean, kind of got the seasons covered. And the other great thing about the bases is they can then have, like, variations. So within this framework of these 10 cakes, I give you these ideas where you could explore or play once you kind of have your confidence up. And then I also kind of give you, like, a range of pan sizes that can work. So, you know, you don't have to do it one particular way. Yeah. There's, like, variations here, and I'll tell you, you know, you'll get this amount. Or it's kind of just, I think once you understand the cake, then you can play.
Yeah.
And get a lot of things from it.
I want to hear a little bit more about Vegemite. So, listener, I'm not going to forget about that question. It will be the last question. But I want to hear about Weekly Children's Birthday Cake book, this iconic Australian children's book that inspired you. I looked at it on Amazon. It was published in 2004. Is that true, or was that a reprint?
No, that's a reprint. I think it was published probably in 1980.
Oh, that's why it looks so cool.
Yeah, it's got retro now.
It looks awesome.
It's never gone out of fashion in Australia. It's still, like, probably the most sold cookbook in Australia. But that's actually was like a huge influence on my relationship with cake. When I was growing up, that book was sold a bit like a magazine was at a news agency. It was really cheap, very accessible, and every kid in my generation owned a copy. And when you'd go to a kid's birthday party, they would have had one of these cakes baked for them. And so part of the joy of it was, like, what are you choosing on the playground? Like, are you getting the pool cake? Or are you getting the rabbit cake or the number cake? Or it was the joy of having to just choose one every year and then going and seeing like how that was interpreted by that family.
And the pressure is on
for the parents
who are making the cake.
Oh my God. Well, I say in the back of Simple Cake, I have like all my childhood stories of my dad trying to pull these cakes off for me. And, it was really like a source of like joy in my childhood, a book that I returned to consistently, like months. I was so excited months in advance before my birthday. I would go to that
so
book.
That's a cool memory.
And start like flicking through it. And then I also think as I got older, when I moved to America, so I moved to America because I met my husband, who is Australia. I met him in the bookstore that I was working in. And then I came here and I really only bought a backpack and I shipped over a box of books that I just had to have with me. And that was one of them. Mm. And Nick has two older children and they were very young at the time. And I used to say to them, choose a cake and I'll bake it for you. And so I started that tradition again over here. I brought it here with me.
Food media in Australia is so cool. And it's consumed in a different way. I feel like you could buy cookbooks at the grocery store.
Yes.
And there's many more magazines per capita than anywhere, right? In Australia and in the UK too, but we'll just focus on Australia.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I think that like Australians are passionate about food. I don't know whether it's a weather thing and that we spend a lot of time outside entertaining, but there's such amazing food in Australia. And I think that they're very passionate about cookbooks and about buying like Delicious Magazine or Gourmet Traveler or just keeping abreast of like what's happening. And even though it's a very small market, it's a, like a super loyal market.
We have a lot of readers from Australia. Shout out to you, Australian readers. And we see them responding. We don't cover Australia enough. So I think it's poignant what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, even just this book, even for this one cake title to have the traction it did back in 1980 to have now sold like a million copies.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And to have that like cultural, it's culturally embedded in my entire generation. I mean, it's kind of phenomenal.
Are you going to do that for the US audience?
Oh my God. Well, actually, that's what I originally pitched to I had originally pitched, because I'd said to Nick, my husband, you know, this book just needs to be redone. Like, it's so great because how the format is and how I kind of got the format for Simple Cake is it has one cake base, two toppings, and then all these, like, designs that you can make from these, like, three core recipes. And it was, and that's what empowered people, like, to be able to pull it off. And to be honest, even if you didn't use that plain butter cake recipe, you could just buy a packet cake and pull them off.
Yeah, I love it. I see the thread now. It's very clear.
Yeah.
Let's get into nuts and bolts. Do you cook by volume or weight? Is it, like, I know that's always an issue with baking books. What's your format? What's your style?
Well, it's funny. If you had spoken to me before the book, I wasn't so pedantic.
Yeah.
You know, I was much more fly by the seat of my pants kind of baker. Just from years of having baked cakes, I had a kind of confidence there to know what I was doing. But through the process of writing it and wanting to teach people and make them feel confident pulling these off, I got pedantic.
Yeah.
So I really now like wait. You know, wait for flour.
You have to. I'm so glad the wind-up was for that answer because I would have been like, volume. You have to have weight for baking.
You do.
It's so important.
No, you really do. And I think one thing that I'm really kind of conscious of for people at home is for years I baked without a scale. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people don't have digital scales. So in the book, I really try and help them to understand how I measure my flour without a scale. So basically what I would do is I get my, you know, flour from, say, in my King Arthur paper box, and I get my spoon and I'll fluff it up and then I'll just scoop it into the measuring cup and then I'll swipe it off any excess with a knife and I won't compact it, I won't bang it down. And if I do it like that, so you guys listening at home, this is how you do it.
Yeah.
This is actually really important.
It's so important.
If you do it like this, you won't overpack your measuring cup with flour. And that honestly is like the biggest downfall to how cakes go wrong. If they have too much flour, then they end up being like dry and dense and they won't have enough liquid in them. And so, you know, that method of where I know that this has been really popular in the past, but where you get your measuring cup and you scoop it in the flour box. For cakes, I don't think that works.
It's
too heavy-handed.
We as home cooks pack everything in because we assume more is better.
Yeah, no.
But that's not the case with pastry.
No. For these cakes in Simple Cake anyway, I'm going to say better to err on the side of having a little less flour in. You might have to add a couple more minutes onto your bake time because there's maybe a little bit more liquid in the cake, but you just don't want to do that. So, like, if you just measure out your flour and if you don't have a baking scale, that
but that's like
the way to do it.
It's the worst case scenario because, honestly, buy a digital scale. They cost literally $17 on Amazon. It's a really good one. Yeah. We've written about it on Taste. We have a great article about buying a digital scale. And if you're baking cakes, it just makes your life so much. It's just easier to use.
It really is. And look, don't be intimidated by the tar button as well. Like, I think that's why also, like, people stop because they just not even quite sure how to use a digital scale.
I think it's like it's like riding a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, but riding a bicycle is so much harder. It's like literally three times you use the tar button.
Yeah.
Which is basically leveling off your weight. So if you're doing putting multiple components, it levels.
Yeah.
You're not over measuring. But once you do it like three times.
Yeah. You've got it.
You have it.
And I even think, guys, that like even if you measure it out once, then you visually have seen what a cup of flour looks like. It's in your memory. It's in your muscle memory about, oh, okay. And that's with all of the cakes, actually, as you go through them. Once you do it once, then you become fluid with it and you'll go, oh, it looks a little, this batter today looks a little thick. I'm going to add, you know, like a tablespoon more milk to it. Or, oh, it's, you know, you get to know the consistency or the measures, or you'll think, oh, God damn it, I didn't pour my butter out early enough. It's too cold. I'll just beat it the beater for like 5 more minutes and, you know, get it softer.
Yep. You'll figure out the tricks. And I think it's, you use the word habit and getting used to these kind of ideas of with home cooking. We drill home at taste, because I think if you set aside like Friday evening or Saturday morning or Sunday afternoon to make a cake 3 weekends out of the year, out of the month, you would actually see yourself. It's just like becomes a habit, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I also think too, the great thing about cake is, and these cakes, is it really doesn't take long and it doesn't cost much. And, you know, usually within an hour, you've got delicious cake.
Oh, it's amazing.
You know, like, and it doesn't have to be just for birthdays. I mean, you know, I was eating cake batter after school, so I'm giving you full permission to have it 365 days of the year.
Last question. Let's get back to the Vegemite sandwich.
Yeah.
Okay, so we as a culture, I think, are going more towards the umami flavor and bitter flavors and salty flavors.
Mm-hmm.
I think Americans typically have had a sweet palate, but I'm pretty sure in the next decade or so, we're going to be switching over to umami.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, will Americans ever love Vegemite?
Oh, God. No. They really won't. You've got to grow up with it, because it is such an acquired taste and it's so salty. I mean, when my kids were young, I forced Vegemite on them so that they actually, like, grew up with that in their palate. But I think also, too, a lot of people don't know how to use Vegemite.
Yeah, I know.
I think they use it like other spreads, like peanut butter.
Mm.
Big mistake. No, you got to let the butter do its work.
It's a
and then you just like smear it on, just ever, you know.
It's
like
such
lightly.
A good combo. I love Vegemite. I love it.
Aww.
I was gonna ask you, Odette Williams. Thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Here's Matt speaking with photographer and author Austin Bush.
Austin Bush, welcome to the Taste Podcast.
Thank you, Matt.
I've followed your work through many of Andy Ricker's books to start.
Mm-hmm.
Pock Pock.
Yeah.
Pock Pock Drinking Food.
Yep.
And then, holy shit, I receive your book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this book is very different and I love it. So congratulations on it.
Thank you. That's also not fair because I haven't seen the book yet, but I'm glad you liked it.
No, your book, Food in Northern Thailand.
Oh, my book. Sorry. I thought you were talking about Andy's new book.
No, your book, The Food in Northern Thailand.
Okay.
I know you have another book that we'll talk about later, a Pock Pock Noodles book. But no, your book, The Food in Northern Thailand, I must say, I've said this, I think, on the podcast, but it's probably my favorite cookbook of 2018.
That's awesome to hear. Thanks a lot, man.
You're welcome. It's true. What I like about it is it blends your just incredible eye for reportage photography and your talents with this deep, deep, deep research and interest in the cuisine and the people. So I wanted to ask you, first off, tell me a little bit about your life, because I think it's really fascinating how you've lived in Thailand for so long. So how did you get into this? Tell me a little bit more about it.
Yeah. So I've been in Thailand a long time now, 20 years, which is kind of crazy, because when I was younger, I really had no interest in Asia. I hadn't spent any time there. It was kind of coincidental. I got a scholarship to go to Laos in Thailand when I was like a junior in college. And that was my first time there. I just found it kind of interesting. And then when I went back to school my last year, I was studying at U of O, University of Oregon. I saw that they had Thai, like, as a topic, and I took Thai for a year there.
The language of, like, the Thai language.
Yeah, yeah, the language. And it was really intense. Like, we had, like, four or five teachers. They were very enthusiastic. I think I learned to read and write Thai in, like, 2 weeks or something
wow.
like that. And liked it. And I've always liked languages. And at the end of that year, I got a scholarship to study Thai at Chiang Mai University in northern Thailand. And I basically have been there since then.
Wow. So you started in Thailand as a student.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you working? What were your first jobs in Thailand?
When that was like one term studying Thai. And then when that was over, I did what a lot of people in Thailand do, which is a lot of foreigners in Thailand, which is teach English. So I did that for like 3 or 4 years, which was cool, but I never meant to become a professional teacher. Mm-hmm. But it's cool because, you know, you get lots of long holidays. And I was always kind of interested in writing photography and food and things like that. So I would get a long holiday and go to Cambodia, take a camera and eat a bunch of weird stuff. Or I would go to Vietnam or I would go to Laos, you know, and did a lot of travel over that period. And I think that kind of kickstarted my interest in food and in that region.
So you were always shooting? You always had a camera in your hand?
Yeah, just for fun. I never thought I would do it, you know, for work or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've always sort of been interested in it.
Okay. And I mean, you clearly made a jump, though, because you aren't an amateur photographer. You have, like, a really clear style. You know how to process. Where did you ever train as a photographer?
No, not like I never studied photography in school
wow.
or anything like that. But over the years, especially, like, early on, I was lucky enough to work as an assistant to a couple different photographers. Mm-hmm. One of the coolest times was this guy called Eric Vallee. He's a French photographer, and he's done, you know, articles in National Geographic. And one thing that he did was these in southern Thailand, there's these caves where swiftlets, these little birds they create these nests and they make them out of their saliva.
Mm-mm.
And those, have you ever heard of this?
Mm-mm, I haven't seen it.
Bird nest soup?
Yeah, I know that. I've heard of it. Okay.
Yeah, so it comes from basically hardened bird saliva.
Yeah.
And there's guys that climb in these caves and chip the nests away and then sell them at a really high
yeah,
price.
Yeah, I've seen those. Andrew Zimmern did a segment on that.
Oh,
once.
Did he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
So I got to work as an assistant to this photographer when he was doing that project, and it was amazing. It was really fun. And
what's it smell like down in one of those caves?
It's pretty gnarly.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being at the mouth of one, and, you know, in sort of corresponding with him before this trip, he was like, have you done any rock climbing? And I had done like a tiny bit at like a rock climbing gym or something like that. And he's like, we got at the mouth of this cave. And he's like, okay, just go. And I had to like belay myself down, which I was not entirely confident of doing. He had to show me how to do the knots and stuff like that. And I reached the bottom of this cave and it was just like a mountain of batshit. Just like, I mean, it was probably hundreds of feet high or something.
Oh,
it looked
my
like
God.
You know, like a child's drawing of a volcano or something.
Yeah.
But a batshit.
Wow, man.
It was insane. Yeah, and it smelled pretty strong.
What other stories were you assisting on before you actually went on your own?
I think that's the only kind of big assisting thing I've done, but I've gone to like workshops here and mm-hmm. there and stuff like that.
Okay. So let's, jump forward to, your book. You wrote a story for Taste kind of about the process, to create the food of Northern Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing you did was buy a truck.
Yes.
What was that all about?
Well, I knew that I wanted to go deep and, you know, go to sort of obscure places off the beaten track. And to do that, I knew, you know, I'd have to have my own wheels. Can't really do that in public transportation. Mm-hmm. And I'd be carrying a bunch of photo equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I just knew that was one of the first things I had to do. So I bought a truck, and I was also, I love cycling. So I was able to throw my bike in the back
yeah.
and occasionally I would roll up somewhere and be able to go for a bike ride as well.
Okay. So you kept all your gear, but you traveled around in this you ended up buying a truck
mm-hmm.
For how long?
So I went halves on the truck with Andy Ricker, and he let me use it for like a year, and then I sold my half back to him.
Okay.
So the better part of a year, a little bit longer than a year, I spent most of that year just driving around northern Thailand.
Wow.
And I have a little sort of like portable photo studio that I took with me.
Yeah.
Throw that in the back seat. And I would take the train up to northern Thailand, go get the car at Andy's place, and just, you know, drive around for a couple weeks. And I forget how many miles I did. It was a lot. A lot of it pretty fruitful, you know, found some really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Dishes I'd hadn't seen before, villages I hadn't been to before. Sometimes a lot of dead ends, lot of driving, and you know, rolling up in places where I couldn't exactly find what I was looking for.
But. Okay, but you were methodical. Was there a grid moment, or were you just driving? How'd that work?
Kind of methodical.
Yeah.
You know, especially in the beginning, I wanted to be very sort of efficient about doing it. So I was relying on friends, parents of friends, restaurants that I was already familiar with, places I'd already been. Mm-hmm. So that was like relatively kind of planned. But, you know, as I talked to these people, they would be like, oh, yeah, in the next village, they do this. Mm-hmm. You should go check that out.
Oh, I see.
And, you know, I'd follow that lead.
And to note, you are fluent in the language.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And that's obviously incredibly helpful.
Oh, it's absolutely necessary in this case. I mean, I would have to have hired a translator or something.
Yeah. You're a white dude from Oregon. You show up to a rural village in northern Thailand and you start speaking in a tongue with a dialect or an accent that, you know, was 20 years seasoned. Were people like, holy shit? Like, were the people kind of stunned?
Yeah, occasionally, because I went to some pretty remote places.
Yeah, you did.
And yeah, there's like places that most tourists, foreign or domestic, don't go to. So people were like really surprised, but more so like kind of like confused. Yeah. Like, why does this guy want to know, you know, how we cook, you know, baby frogs, or, you know, why does he want to know about this dip? Like, they just couldn't wrap their heads around it.
Right.
But at the same time, they were really like kind of impressed that someone from outside, clearly an outsider, was interested in their stuff.
Yeah.
And that really shone through. Like, people were so generous and so nice and like so kind of enthusiastic to show stuff.
Yeah, it's very clear in the book that there was a mutual respect there with your subjects, the folks you interviewed. Great stories. I wanted to hear a little bit about homestays, mm-hmm. because that seemed to be a reporting technique that you used for the book.
Yeah, it was. A lot of the recipes came from those. And that's because I would hit up restaurants quite a bit, and most of the restaurant owners in northern Thailand were really generous. And I didn't even have to ask twice. You know, they would just let me into their kitchens and show me exactly how they made these dishes. But occasionally, you know, people don't want to share their recipes, and that's totally cool. And I, you know, I write guidebooks for Lonely Planet as well. And I was aware that there are these little homestays in kind of remote communities in northern Thailand. And I thought that would just be kind of an interesting way to get real home cooking as opposed to restaurant cooking, which are, you know, different entities. And also, I kind of discovered after doing that a few times that people were not so sort of guarded about their recipes. They were really enthusiastic to share them. They loved sharing them, kind of unlike restaurants. I would drive. I would look it up. I would call in advance. And they're usually facilitated by some guy, like the village headman or something like that. And I'd be like, hey, I'm this American writer, journalist. I'm writing about local food. I've heard that you guys do this dish. I'd like to stay at the homestay, but could you put me with the family in the village that has the best reputation for cooking?
What's a dish, for example? Just give one.
Oh, God, what was? I mean, I stayed at a hill tribe homestay. So in northern Thailand, there's a lot of different people who are not necessarily Thai. And there are a lot of ethnic groups that are kind of grouped together known as hill tribes. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in their food because almost nothing is ever written about it. And so I heard that there's one group called the Lahu lived in this village. So I drove all the way out there. And this woman made this kind of amazing dip. It's so simple. It's just in the sort of coals at the, you know, as the fires died, she tossed in a few chilies and then a big chunk of ginger and grilled that. Maybe some shallots, I think, and grilled it until it was really tender and fragrant, peeled all the burnt stuff off, pounded it up in a mortar and pestle, and with a lot of cilantro leaves, and then served it with grilled pork. Mm. And it's so simple.
Wow, sounds great.
It's really tasty, and it was so spicy, but not necessarily from the chili, from the garlic, or I'm sorry, the ginger, that ginger sort of spiciness.
Yeah.
It was really, really tasty.
And so are you asking questions along the way? Are you watching her make this? Are you taking video too?
Yeah. And that's the challenging part because I wrote and photographed this book.
Yeah, no. It's incredibly hard.
So I would...
Rare. It's rare.
It was hard. It was like logistically kind of almost impossible at sometimes. I would be squatting there, you know, taking photos, also with a notepad, also with my phone to take video of these kind of complicated techniques and stuff like that. And in the end, I managed to do it, but it was pretty hard. And like, I think when I was doing that, like, I kind of learned that because I was both writing and photographing, one of those things kind of gets compromised.
Yeah.
And so in general, I'm not so confident in my writing skills, and I think I kind of overemphasized taking notes. And I kind of wish I could go back and have taken a few more photos, but I was very, like, sort of diligent about recording everything.
You never know until you do the first one that, you know, how much do you actually need? How much can you report in the secondary moment?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to hear about some of the dishes that you just really adore from the region. Like, mm-hmm. what are your favorite foods? Because you don't live in Northern Thailand, you live in Bangkok. Is that mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah.
But so you, which is much different than Northern Thailand. But
yeah.
Let's talk about some of the northern dishes that you really love.
Sure. So there's a province in Northern Thailand called Mahusan, and it's like on the border with Myanmar, in kind of the northwesternmost corner of Thailand. And most of the people who live there are this ethnic group called Shan. And their food is like a little bit closer to Burmese food. So it's not very spicy. It's very mild. It's kind of oily, but in a nice way. They love like umami, tomatoes, like fermented soybeans. They do a lot of stuff with rice. Like they'll mix it with turmeric and wrap it in a banana leaf and steam it, or roll it into balls mixed with tomato and serve it with pork rinds. And I really like their food. You don't see it anywhere else in Thailand. And it has flavors that really sort of I like savory flavors, not sweet at all, very mild, very fragrant. So I love that stuff. I think it's really delicious.
I want to know if I'm going to Northern Thailand. So say I'm traveling and I fly into Bangkok, I spend some time there, and I want to head north.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Chiang Mai is a large city that oftentimes is the center of a tourist northern experience.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where I should go? Are there other places to visit that you think are maybe better?
Yeah. I mean, of course, Chiang Mai is the biggest city in northern Thailand, and it's the natural starting point.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to find a little bit of everything there. But definitely, if you're serious about it, go to some other places.
Mm-hmm.
There's another destination I really like is this town maybe 4 hours from Chiang Mai in the opposite direction going east. And it's called Pra. And it's northern Thai food, but sort of with an emphasis on meat. So a lot of the most famous like vendors who sell grilled meat or lap or like these meaty stews come from there. And it's a very small town, but it's charming. And I don't know, there's a couple of restaurants there that are so good. And definitely worth like driving 4 hours, and food that you're not getting anywhere else, even in northern Thailand.
And you could take a bus there?
Yeah, you could take a bus there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Tell me a little bit more about your life in Bangkok when you weren't reporting the book.
Mm-hmm.
What are you up to there?
So I do a mix of writing and photography. My sort of day job is doing guidebooks.
Uh-huh.
I work for Lonely Planet.
Yeah.
And I have since 2006, I guess. So I've done like, I don't know, like I haven't counted, like at least 30 guidebooks for Lonely Planet, which involves going to like a lot of places in mainland Southeast Asia, Laos, Myanmar, Vietnam, Malaysia. Yeah.
What? So that's fascinating to me because I've written a couple guidebooks, one for Brooklyn, the Brooklyn photos. I did mm-hmm. a couple chapters.
Oh, cool.
And it's so difficult. It's tedious work.
It's tremendously tedious.
It's uh-huh. incredibly obviously facts based.
Yeah.
Though you can certainly put in quite a bit of opinion. But wow, what's it like for you? So say you're doing a book. Is it an update for Vietnam? Like, what does this mean?
Yeah. At this point, they're all updates, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll roll into a place. I'll do some research, obviously. I'll try and find some local contacts. But it's a balance, you know? I mean, maybe you felt that when you did your guidebook. Like, there's certain places in a destination that are always going to be in a guidebook, sort of emblematic of that place. I, being especially interested in food and local food, I really want to steer people towards that. And I think a lot of guidebooks don't do a super great job at that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have a balance, you know, like for Lonely Planet guides, we'll always try and include a couple vegetarian places or, you know, a Western place or quasi-Western place, because we need to kind of appeal to a wide sort of swath of people. But in general, I try and make a huge effort to like point people towards local food, which it can be hard and intimidating if you don't have a little bit of handholding, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of these places don't have English language signs, or you can't communicate with the staff or whatever. So
it must be gratifying to put in a small, like just couple owners, tiny place into the Lonely Planet guidebook.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you would hope that it would help their situation. It would increase their business, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a restaurant in northern Thailand in this kind of like backpackery town called Pai, P-A-I. And this town is a huge destination for backpackers. You can get hamburgers there. You can get falafel, but you can't really get northern Thai food, oddly enough, except for this one place. And I've been eating there for years, and I wrote it up in the guidebook, and I did all these things to kind of draw people to it.
Yeah, the little tricks. I did that myself. Uh-huh. You just have to really, you know, the language, you want to draw them in.
Yeah.
You know, the met, the special words.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I did that, and I hadn't been there for a while, and came back, and the lady recognized me, and she's like, oh my God, you're back. She's like, I'm so happy we get foreigners here every day. She's like, look, I got a new roof for my restaurant.
Oh, my gosh.
That made me feel so good.
That's such a good story.
But the funny thing was, she's like, the restaurant was a bit cleaner, a bit tidier. She's like, look, we have an English language menu on the wall. Mm-hmm. And I looked, and they had these kind of like terrible pictures of the food.
Oh, no, yeah.
Which, you know, they were trying, but these kind of unclear pictures of the food. And then below it in English was, I don't know how to explain this. It wasn't the English language name of the dish, but rather like the transliteration.
Yeah.
So instead of saying pork rinds, it said kepmu, but in English words, you know. So it really wasn't helping.
It was
anybody.
Just transliterating the Thai. It's more like point and eat at that point.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. But whatever. I was so like kind of impressed by that, and that. Yeah, that made me feel great. Like, I love it when I can do that sort of thing.
So what is on tap for you? What other guidebooks do you have lined up? And talk about maybe some other book projects you're working on your own.
Yeah, sure. I'm in the middle of doing the Laos Guide for Lonely Planet right now, which is cool because that's, I think, the very first guide I ever did.
Yeah.
And I haven't been there back there too much. So
since you actually did the guide. So what's the time frame?
I think I was there in like 2009 or something.
Oh, wow. So 10 years. Wow.
I've been there a little bit off and on, but I haven't done a guidebook in a while. So it's kind of interesting to see the changes there. And Lao food is pretty similar to Thai food.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. It's really, really delicious.
Yeah.
So that's fun. I did the photos for Andy Ricker's soon-to-be-released noodle book, which is coming out, I think, in a couple of weeks.
Pretty
from now.
Soon, yeah. It'll be out this summer for sure. Yeah.
Which I haven't even seen yet, so I'm
yeah.
really looking forward to seeing that.
Good.
And then my next book, I'd like to do one on Southern Thai food.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't signed a contract or anything, but I've been talking to my editor and my publishing company, and mm-hmm. I think they like the idea. And
the food of Southern Thailand?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's it. Following the same format, same aesthetic, same look, but this what is essentially like a really, really different cuisine.
Yeah, and then you'll, of course, go to the islands too?
Yeah, yeah. I've been to a couple already.
Yeah.
I wanted to put together a good proposal for them. So I did a few research trips.
Oh, nice.
I did an article for Saver in the course of doing that. And I love it. Like, I love Northern Thai food, but mm-hmm. I'm interested in kind of all foods. And Southern Thai food is just so, like, kind of, it's the spiciest Thai regional food. It's really, really full flavored. It's really salty. It's really, like, beautiful. Like, Northern Thai food is delicious and amazing, but it kind of – it's not very aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah, sure.
A lot of it's kind of brown or green. But in Southern Thailand, you get, like, bright yellow from all the turmeric or red or, you know, these this thing called sitaw, like stink beans that are bright green. And it's really colorful.
Are you going to do the same thing? You're going to buy a truck?
I don't know.
And drive down there?
I guess so. I haven't worked that out yet. I'm just starting, but I think I might have to buy a car and just sort of park it down there.
I'm really excited. I hope I can come on a research trip with you.
Oh, man, you're welcome. Yeah. Well, how's your spice tolerance?
I can handle some spice.
Okay.
I've done some. I wrote a book about Korean food, so I have a little bit of spice.
There you go. Yeah.
But I will say I haven't really driven through Thailand. I've only been to Koh Samui and Bangkok. So.
Okay.
Austin, you got to show me the way.
We'll do it. Yeah, let's do it.
Austin Bush, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
The Taste podcast is hosted by Matt Rodbard and me, Anna Heasel. The show is produced by Gabrielle Lewis, studio recordings by Pat Stango, theme music by Steve Rydell. Interviews are recorded live at Books Are Magic in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, and at Penguin Random House Studios in Manhattan. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com. Thanks for listening.